Good evening, everyone, and thank you for making time to join us. We're going to be talking about Iraq with Raed Jarar, and the discussion is ending the war in Iraq with a colon and questions, elements of a success story. I will not have a long introduction. I just want to say how pleased I am and how lucky we all are to have some time to hear some analysis from Raed, but we also will have at least 20 minutes or maybe longer to have some discussion and dialogue on what might be some of the next steps we can take or what are some of the issues we should be watching out for and what are some of the trends that may take place in Iraq and how can we engage with those. This evening's presentation really is encapsulated in a long sentence. This is a long time coming, the removal of U.S. combat troops from Iraq, and it's left a tremendous tragedy for the Iraqi people and for us in this country. It was a war of choice. It destroyed the infrastructure, left hundreds of thousands dead, opened the way to civil war, ethnic fighting, and created the largest movement of refugees and internally displaced in the region since the creation of Israel in 1948. These are long-lasting legacies, and they're issues that we need to remember and think about as we see some of the press coverage that's going to be looking for ways to commemorate or comment on this devastating war that has really been so integral in the last decade since 9/11 and the response that this country chose. So with that, I'll just say that Raed is an Iraq specialist and former AFSC consultant. He's a fascinating blogger at Raed in the Middle. He also is active with a Twitter account and often a commentator on Democracy Now!, so there's many opportunities for you to follow his thinking, but this is really a special opportunity for you to also ask him some questions. So, Raed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Peter. I don't know whether you can hear me or not. I hope I'm not muted.
We can hear you.
Thanks a lot for inviting me to this conference call, and I'm very thankful that AFSC is working on the Iraq issue again. I had the privilege to join the AFSC team for a few years during the occupation, and we did a lot of work. Like I assume many of the people on this call did as well, many people dedicated their lives to see a day where all of the U.S. troops leave Iraq. So I'm very happy that we are approaching that date. It seems that within the next few weeks, the U.S. military occupation will be over. In Iraq, and the war between the U.S. and Iraq will be officially over. This means a lot to me. This is a war that started more than 20 years ago, and I spent most of my life living in this war, whether it began in 1991 with bombings and a campaign that destroyed most of Iraq, and continued through 13 years of sanctions that were devastating. I lived in Iraq for 10 years of those 13 years, and I went back just a few weeks before the 2003 invasion and lived there through the invasion and 1 year of the military occupation. So many people did, including myself, devoted our lives to fighting against this illegal and immoral occupation of Iraq. I used to work as an architect before the U.S. invaded Iraq, and put my career on hold, and have been doing, more political and social work focused at this point, which is withdrawing the last U.S. soldier. I will talk a little bit about the success story that we had, with the war, and of course about the things that we still need to do, and looking forward, what must be done regarding Iraq and the U.S.-Iraqi relationships. I think one of the main reasons why we are approaching this historic date where the occupation of Iraq will be over is that there was an agreement that set an agreement on a deadline for all troop withdrawal and all bases closure. This is something that I personally advocated for in 2006, in 2007, and 2008, and AFSC helped push in that direction as well. We invited multiple delegations from the Iraqi parliament, one of the delegation brought an official letter signed by the majority of Iraqi blocs in the parliament, stating that they will not sign or approve any agreement between the U.S. and Iraq unless that agreement includes a deadline for all troop withdrawal and all bases closure. That letter is on the congressional record, and I think that letter did set the tone inside the United States on what the Iraqi parliament wants. I think before that, in 2004 and 2005, no one even knew what the Iraqi parliament was. No one knew that the Iraqi parliament represented the Iraqi people's will in ending the military occupation, while the Iraqi executive branch, the cabinet and other institutions that were not elected directly by the people, were more tolerant and supportive of the U.S. occupation. I don't think the U.S. public or even activists were aware of this until, of course, those moments came when we had delegations over. So I think that was it was a very important moment to learn from, that ending a war and an occupation requires an Iraqi or a partner from the other nation. I think collaborating with Iraqi organizations and with Iraqi legislators was essential in building bridges between the anti-war movement here in the U.S. and the anti-war and occupation movement in Iraq. That was extremely important and productive. The second point was setting a deadline for all troop withdrawal. In 2008, I personally and AFSC as an organization was put under attack by many progressive groups because we called for supporting the agreement that set a deadline for all troop withdrawal. Now, the criticism came mainly because of two reasons. One of them is the deadline was too far. In 2008, we were talking about the end of 2011. It just seemed like it's forever to wait for 3 or 4 years. And the other reason was that the details of how this these 3 years would look like, between 2008 and the end of 2011, the details were unfair. I personally agreed with the fact that the details were unfair, that the U.S. troops were granted immunities that they don't deserve and they should not have, that Iraqis did not have full sovereignty and independence for their country, and other issues that has to do with Iraq's ability to decide its own economic and political policies. But the bottom line that I believe was the only thing that I personally believed in was the need for a solid deadline for all troop withdrawal. And even if that deadline was a couple of years or 3 years after, at least we have to put that deadline. I think in other cases similar to Iraq and the occupation, that is something that we have to keep in mind, that ending an occupation will not go through negotiating troop level and pressuring the administration to remove 5,000 troops or add 5,000 troops, do a surge here, do a reduction there, or be nicer in the occupation, or teach our soldiers how to be more cultured. All of these issues are irrelevant details to ending the occupation. The occupation must end by putting a deadline for all troop departure and all bases closure. This is exactly what is needed to ensure that any occupation, whether it was in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other U.S. military involvement, would end indeed. And so I think like one of the very few organizations that was committed to even putting some oversight on the agreement was AFSC and many other partners that helped. We have a countdown to travel website that has literally a counter counting days on how many days are left for the last U.S. soldier to leave Iraq. And I remember when we started the countdown to travel, we had, I think, 1,000 days on the counter. It didn't really fit. We had to wait for a few days until we reached to 999 so that we will launch the campaign. And it just felt like it was forever. And I remember one day I emailed Dieter telling him that we have 500 days left. So we were halfway through. Today the counter is 19. And I hope, before it reaches to zero, that the last U.S. soldier will be Iraq. Mm-hmm. Let me say one last point before we open the floor for questions. I'm sure that there are many issues that we can discuss tonight. But before we go there, let me stress the importance of not only pressuring the U.S. government to withdraw all of its troops, but also the importance of ending all the bases. That was something really important because there are, of course, many examples of the U.S. withdrawing its troops from countries around the Middle East and the world, but keeping military bases there. For example, the U.S. has permanent military bases in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar. And in those two countries, there aren't U.S. Troops there. The U.S. is not maintaining thousands of troop presence there. But the bases are huge. They are fully equipped, and they can become functional major military bases within hours or days when the U.S. ships troops there. The case in Iraq is that all of these military bases will be closed. So, of course, I can talk more about this during the, if you have any more questions. But overall, I think looking back to see this major success for the U.S. and Iraqi anti-occupation movements and the learning from it to try to use, the tools and methods that worked in Afghanistan and elsewhere is important. At the same time, we have to keep in mind the fact that the U.S., while the U.S. war and occupation are ending, the U.S. involvement and intervention in Iraq is not ending. the U.S. will maintain 16,000 personnel in Iraq beyond the December 31st deadline. And I will talk more about this. Of course, I'm sure that many of you will have questions about that point. So let me stop here, Peter, if you think, we can open the floor for questions, let's go ahead and do that.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. In fact, that was going to be my first question, was the size of the U.S. Embassy that has been announced by the State Department. So we will table that as the first question. But what I also wanted to thank you to point out the importance of a deadline. And I think as we're thinking of lessons learned with Afghanistan, certainly all of this discussion is avoiding setting any kind of deadline, and everything is open-ended, and everything is adjusting the edges without really confronting the issue. So what we are going to open the lines, and I'm not sure if Lem needs a second for that, but while people are being unmuted, can we start with some of your observations on the size of the U.S. Embassy, and in particular, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but what the embassy role might be with the compensation fund that Iraq is still paying into, and what you're kind of thinking about that as a model for wars of aggression and the obligation of countries responsible for that to offer some sort of compensation.
Sure. I will address both points. The first point regarding the U.S. State Department's presence in Iraq. The State Department will maintain the largest footprint in history for an embassy in any country. There is no equivalent of an embassy maintaining 16,000 personnel in any country. Now, half of these 16,000 personnel will be armed security contractors, mercenaries who hold guns, who can shoot at, Iraqis. So it's very disturbing. It's very concerning. The other half will be split, the other 8,000. We will have 4,000 embassy employees and 4,000 non-armed contractors. Those contractors who cook, who clean, who wash dishes. They call them in the State Department lingo, life support contractors. So around 16,000 personnel left in six different sites around the country. Of course, the main site is the U.S. Embassy Baghdad, and the other five sites include two consulates and two diplomatic representation sites and one, believe it or not, airport. It's a military airport that used to be a part of Camp Victory near the Iraqi airport in Baghdad. And now it became under the control of the U.S. Embassy. So, of course, the very obvious point of comparison is the Iraqi mission to the United States, compared to 16,000 personnel with an airport and six sites around the country. Iraq will maintain, around maybe 16, somewhere between a dozen and two dozen employees in the United States. So the number is, it just shows you the contrast. I like to give the contrast because I believe a healthy way to build a relationship between the United States and Iraq is for that relationship to be a balanced relationship based on peer-to-peer relationships and mutual respect. 5 employees in Iraq, Iraq should leave 5 in the U.S. And this is a vision that I have for collaboration between the U.S. and other countries around the world. The collaboration should not be lopsided, where the U.S. maintains thousands of people and interferes in domestic policies, while other countries just maintain a handful of employees who do administrative work for their own citizens here. So it is extremely problematic, the size of the embassy. One point that I have been suggesting as a lobbying point for us to work around is the fact that the State Department's own Inspector General put a report in 2009 that recommended what he called right-sizing the embassy. He meant downsizing the embassy in Baghdad. So the report is very clear in demanding a significant downsize of the U.S. embassy in Iraq because the Inspector General thinks it's too expensive and hard to maintain. There is no real reason to keep it there, so it should be downsized. So the State Department not only ignores its own Inspector General's recommendations, but they go ahead and double their size. You know, last year they were half the size of what it will be, they will be within the next few weeks. So this is ridiculous. It is not in the U.S. interest to continue this huge, expensive presence in Iraq because, you know, it will continue the negative image of the United States that the U.S. is an imperialist country continuing its intervention in Iraq's domestic politics. It might even lead to more violence against the U.S. presence. I have read very serious threats to attack the embassy and embassy employees unless they leave Iraq before the end of this year. These threats are not just should not just be taken in account because they are threats of violence, but also because they reflect an Iraqi sentiment in rejecting a continuation of the U.S. intervention in their country. So I think, you know, while we celebrate the end of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, this illegal and criminal occupation that has caused the death of over 1 million civilians in Iraq in the last 8 years alone, and the death of thousands of U.S. Armed forces who were not supposed to be there in the first place, the occupation that has caused the displacement of 5 million Iraqis in the last 8 years alone. The last time I went to Baghdad, the city that I was born at, the city that I graduated from, you know, I went to the University of Baghdad and graduated there. I did not know a single person in the city, not a single person from my family or friends or neighbors or colleagues. No one. Everyone was either killed or fled the city. So imagine the level of destruction for this war. So while we celebrate the end of this occupation, we have to keep in mind that our mission is not over yet. Our work is not over, and it will not be over until we, finish other important steps forward. And those steps include downsizing the U.S. State Department's mission, so that it will become as large as the Iraqi, embassy in D.C. And this will take me, it's a good leeway to answer your second question, Peter, which is the question about compensation, which I think is essential for building the future of the U.S.-Iraqi relationships. The level of destruction and murders and mistakes and crimes that were committed in Iraq in the last 20 years won't just go away. It won't just vanish. We have to address all of these crimes and all of the destruction that happened in Iraq. Every Iraqi who was harmed because of this illegal and immoral war must be compensated by the United States, and Iraq as a nation must be compensated by the United States and all the other countries that took part of this war against Iraq. One of the very good examples that we can learn from is what Peter mentioned earlier, which is the compensation that, believe it or not, Iraq has been paying to Kuwait for the last 20 years because of the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait. I think the Iraqi invasion and occupation of Kuwait was indeed an illegal and immoral act that continued for 8 or 9 months. Iraq has been paying a very heavy price under a United Nations commission called the United Nations Compensation Commission, UNCC. They have a very informative website if you would like to check it out, UNCC. Iraq has been paying billions of dollars to Kuwait and to Kuwaitis to compensate them for the damages that occurred, for the crimes and for the mistakes that happened during the Iraqi invasion and occupation of Kuwait. So UNCC has a very good standard for us to depend on in estimating the compensation that must be paid to Iraq because of the U.S. and other U.S. allies' invasion and occupation of Iraq. The compensations that must be paid to Iraqis who were injured and harmed, to the Iraqi families that lost their loved ones, to all of the victims of the 20-year war, victims of the 1991 war, victims of the sanctions that killed thousands of Iraqi children every month, and victims of this ongoing occupation that started 8 years ago and must be ending by the end of this year. I don't think the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad would have to do anything with the Iraqi compensation to Kuwait, because that's a United Nations issue handled by the United Nations, not by the U.S. I think the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad should learn from that, from that model. I'm personally not advocating for compensation to Iraq just because I am an Iraqi, but also because I am an American. And I think it's a very important investment in peace for us to compensate Iraqis. And it's a very important moral obligation. It's a personal moral obligation for each of us who paid taxes in the last years and funded this war. You know, I feel personally responsible of these attacks that happened against Iraqis. Because although I was against the war, I continued to pay taxes. And these taxes were, unfortunately, funding the bombs and bullets that were used to kill Iraq. I think looking forward, the idea of compensation is extremely important and should be one of the pillars of the future of the U.S.-Iraqi relationships if we were serious in building healthy relationships going forward.
I like that. I like that language, one of the pillars. Okay, so we're going to open up the lines. People can still send a question if you happen to be in front of your computer to questions@afsc.org, and I'll get those and pass them on. But I think we'll take a second to unmute all the lines, and then...
The conference has been unmuted.
Okay, Peter, back over to you.
And then now you're all able to join in. What I wanted to do was perhaps to start with to just take a stack. So if you're interested in asking a question, just call out your name, and I'll collect the first couple, and then we'll pass those on to Rod.
At the beginning of the stack, I just wanted to, excuse me, Paul, I just wanted to let everybody know that if I'm on a, I have a console where I can watch the call, and if your line gets noisy, I might mute it in the background. So just remember, if you start to talk and you don't think you're being heard, star 7 will always unmute your own line. Okay, back. Paul, I think you were going to get on the stack?
Yes.
Okay, anyone else?
Daryl.
Joan.
Okay, let's start with first three. Okay, Paul, what's your question?
Hi, Rod. This is Paul Shannon.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Good. Nice to hear you again. Rod, could you clarify for us the situation with the U.S. bases? Does the agreement call for closing all those bases, for dismantling all those bases, for turning the bases over to the Iraqis? I mean, these are huge bases. What does the agreement actually call for, and what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, most of the, actually all of the above, the agreement calls for closing or dismantling or turning over bases to Iraqis based on every base. And that is because many of the bases were actually Iraqi bases to start with that the U.S. Took over. So those ones will be handed back to the Iraqi side. Some bases were dismantled and closed by the United States. Some bases I read on some Iraqi websites that the U.S. had to burn some bases when they left because they did not want Iraqis to use them or use the materials that were left there. A few years ago, the U.S. had 505 military bases and installations. As of today, the number is 4. There are 4 bases left, and these 4 bases must be shut down and handed over to the Iraqi side within the next couple of weeks. And that's, I think, I always thought that that was a very important requirement. And that was one of the most victories that we had against the Bush administration's agenda. Because the Bush administration planned and actually built a number of bases that were meant to be permanent bases that would stay for decades in Iraq. Bush called them the Korea model. He wanted to have bases like in South Korea for another 5 or 6 decades. So I thought that was extremely important to include in the bilateral agreement, and that now the U.S. is actually implementing that. The U.S. will not leave a single base in Iraq, not one base in the entire country. Not even an empty base that they can use in the future. That said, there was one attempt that the Pentagon tried, and it failed. It was officially declared as a failed attempt yesterday. That attempt was to keep 3,000 to 4,000 U.S. troops as quote-unquote trainers under the NATO umbrella. So they tried to pass an agreement through the Iraqi parliament to grant NATO group troops immunities and then keep the U.S. troops as NATO troops. But then that failed. I expected that it would fail. And it thankfully failed. So now it is official that neither the U.S. nor the NATO will have a single base, a military base in Iraq. Now, that said, I did mention the fact that the State Department will have 6 sites around the country. That includes the largest embassy in the history of mankind in Baghdad and the other 4 sites around the country under different names, consulate here and temporary diplomatic mission here and there. And these are, in a way, they are bases of intervention. They are non-military, but nevertheless, Iraq doesn't have, thousands of Iraqis in around the United States spread over different offices interfering in domestic politics. So it is very concerning, and get rid of all of the military bases, we have to get rid of these non-military bases as well.
Thank you.
Great. Daryl.
Thank you. All righty. I'm interested to know, do you have any idea what those thousands of folks are needed for over there? I mean, I know they're not needed, but what are they going to be doing? When somebody asks me why we need 6,000 people and why 8,000 people armed, is there an answer to this?
Yeah, yes, there is an answer. The answer is they are not needed for anything. Iraq does not need 16,000 U.S. State Department personnel to stay there, period. That is the answer. Now, the U.S. Or some powers in the U.S. government are hoping that they will continue to interfere and influence Iraq through this EU presence. The U.S. has very huge embassies in other countries around the region that play an important role in determining the domestic and foreign policies of those countries. And I think the hope now is that this, the U.S. embassy in Baghdad will play a similar role by coordinating with Iraqi authorities and influencing them on a daily basis. I hope this plan will fail, and I hope Iraqi leaders will have enough political awareness and enough political capital to say no to daily interventions from the U.S. military. And I hope the U.S. leaders, I hope Obama and Clinton, will reach to a conclusion that this is not the right path forward. We have been trying this path for the last 20 years, the path of intervention and hegemony and pressuring Iraq and pushing Iraq around, and that path did not work. We have to stop that mentality. It's about changing our mentality. It's not just about withdrawing the troops. It's not just about not dropping bombs. It's about changing the mentality of collaboration, that it doesn't seem that the change has happened yet. So that's why I think there is a lot of work to do. We have to make these points very clear. These 16,000 people are not welcome. They are not needed. And they are not in the interest of the U.S. or Iraq to stay there. We're talking about a mission that will cost U.S. taxpayers between $6 and $8 billion a year, billion with a B. It's huge. It's enormous. The price of this is very financially it's enormous, and of course the price to the U.S. reputation and political capital is very enormous as well. Instead of the U.S. coming across as a country that is trying to open a new page, it looks like a bitter loser, a bitter ender who doesn't want to, move on and stop its intervention. And, unfortunately, that might continue the violence against the U.S. in Iraq and the rest of the region. I don't think it's worth it to continue this presence in Iraq, and I think it's sound policy to reduce the size of the U.S. mission in Iraq to a few dozen employees, the same way that Iraq has a few dozen employees in the United States.
Great. Joan, before we get to your question, I just have one follow-up. From what I've seen, it appears that it won't be comfortable or easy for any U.S. embassy personnel to move about freely. Are they going to also be living in a bubble in however they're able to perhaps protect the compound of the embassy, but certainly not able to engage with Iraqi communities?
Actually, one of the things that I have been doing in the last year and a half is that I have been working in Iraq. I was traveling back and forth to Iraq, working with one of the U.S. Organizations funded by the State Department. I informed them that I'm not interested in going beyond the deadline of this year, so I won't be going anymore. While I was going there, I was going as an American, not as an Iraqi, And I could not, I couldn't see anything that happened in Baghdad because I was received at the airport by armored vehicles that belong to security firms, Iraqi security firms that are hired by the State Department, move around the city with 8 or 10 bodyguards and 3 armored vehicles. We're not allowed to leave the compound. Believe it or not, even inside the compound that I was staying at, Iraqis were not allowed in the same restaurant that I ate at or other Americans went to. Iraqis were not allowed in the same gym. Iraqis were not allowed in the same, barber shop. It's a system of segregation inside these compounds. There is a mall in the green zone that Iraqis are not allowed to enter to it. There are different policies of entering and exiting the green zone and the airport based on me being an American and them not. It's a disgusting situation, and I was feeling very disturbed that I was a part of that regime of discrimination against Iraqis. I did my best to change many of these policies. I brought it up with even the heads of the organization here in D.C. And I will continue to do that. And I did encourage all of my coworkers to quit before the end of this year. I think it's an important political statement for all of us to stop working with the State Department before December 31st, 2011. To answer your question, Peter, no one has any contact with Iraqis. For God's sake, people don't have contact with Iraqis who work inside the green zone. They don't have contact with Iraqis who work in their office. There is a system of segregation completely. And that's why when I say that these missions in Iraq are not meant to build bridges with Iraqis, reach out to their counterparts and have some communication, because I know that there is no interest in building bridges, and there are no precedents of U.S. presence for building bridges. There isn't really any communications happening with the Iraqi side.
We're going to get Joan's question. I also want to first see if anyone else wants to be on stack to ask a question.
This is Jennifer. Can I ask a question, Peter?
Okay, Jennifer. Anyone else?
Yeah, this is Scylla. I'd like to be on.
Scylla. Okay, so Joan, you first and then Jennifer Scylla.
Okay.
I think, go ahead.
Okay. Going back, I have a big question also about oil, but I'm just going back in recent history since you mentioned Kuwait. I've been under the understanding that actually the United States really used this, the invasion of Kuwait, to justify U.S. intervention and international, bringing other countries into this, that actually Kuwait was slant drilling, and I haven't been sure about this, whether it was from a disputed area or whether it was actually an Iraqi area of oil.
After
Iraq went into Kuwait. And so I think because people don't know about this, if in fact this is so.
Good question.
Yeah. There were very annoying and illegal provocations from Kuwait to Iraq during that time. I personally, I'm not a big fan of the Kuwaiti ruling family's politics or their relationships to their neighbors or the culture that they have dealing with Iraqis or Saudis or Jordanians or anyone. But at the same time, I don't think that the Iraqi government at that time dealt with those provocations the right way. Invading and occupying a neighboring country is a crime that is unjustifiable, regardless of what you know the mistakes that Kuwait committed. I don't think the actions of Iraq are justified. There are many stories about Kuwait, you know, pumping oil like that, and of course the more mainstream story, which I knew all along, and it was leaked through two important documents that WikiLeaks made available to the public a few months ago during meetings between Saddam Hussein and the U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, that one of the main reasons that Saddam personally and the Iraqi government was feeling uneasy about, and they were, you know, using that as an excuse later to justify their invasion of Kuwait, it was that Kuwait was pumping so much oil and was bringing the price of oil down. And it was that Kuwait was asking Iraq to pay back all of the financial assistance that Kuwait has given to Iraq during the 8 years of the Iraq-Iran war. Iraq thought that the financial assistance was not a loan. They thought it was a gift because Iraq was, in its own way, protecting Kuwait and other Arab countries from what they thought is an Iranian invasion or whatever other political excuses they had. Iraq thought that the Kuwaiti export of oil was unjustified and it was meant to harm Iraq. I think this is, like, you know, too old now to go back and look at. But overall, I think that although many of these points might be valid, did not justify the Iraqi occupation. The United Nations acted within its authorities under the international law at that time. It authorized the use of power under Charter 7 against, you know, one country that invaded another. Unfortunately, we see selective implementation of that. The United Nations did not use that against the U.S. when the U.S. invaded and occupied Iraq without authorization of the U.N. And of course, you know, the United Nations does not use that against Israel or other countries around the world that have more privileges inside the U.N. So although the actions were technically legal, I think now when we think about them politically, the U.N. did give a legal cover and justification for the U.S. plans in Iraq and the region.
Great. Okay, so we're getting close to the end of our time, and we can bleed over a little bit, but I have Jennifer next and then Scylla. And I have a couple of questions that have come in as well.
I'll keep my answers short.
Keep your answers short, and let's see if we can get through all the questions.
Sure.
Okay, thanks, Ryan. I was wondering if you could list off or describe what the most pressing needs of the Iraqi people are at this point, with the U.S. departure being a positive thing, and now what lies kind of ahead of them for their own development work?
I think there is a long list of needs. Iraq needs to build a state. Iraq needs to build a society, rebuild a state, rebuild a society. Everything has been destroyed. The question at hand is what is our role in that? Because we are not all Iraqis, you know. There are things that must be solved by Iraqis, like rebuilding their armed forces or national reconciliation, etc. I think from our side, as Americans, we have to first ensure the end of all forms of intervention, and that, of course, happens through pressuring the State Department to downsize its size, and then work on issues of reconciliation between the U.S. and Iraq, and compensation to Iraqis. I think these are the most important pressing items from this side. Was this short enough, Peter?
Wow. Well, I have a follow-up question that came online that will maybe allow you to expand a little bit more. And this is from Anonymous, or someone called Anonymous, not Anonymous. And he said, a friend once characterized Baghdad as being as cosmopolitan, as sophisticated, as treasured a city as Montreal. Can that return? For me, that would be the end of this nightmare and a new rightful start for Iraq.
Yes, I'm 100% sure it will return one day. Whether this day will come after a decade or two decades, it will come. Ending the occupation is an extremely important step to help Iraqis achieve that.
Okay, excellent. Scylla.
I think mine's very quick. Fade, thanks for this. It's great. What will happen? Will the contractors and the soldiers in the embassy, will they be subject to Iraqi law, or will the green zone be, because they're the embassy, I guess they're not. So what will be the situation within the Iraqi law to those?
Well, they have the protection of the embassy, which is right. It's international, the same way that Iraqi employees inside the Iraqi embassy are protected. But they are not immune. The U.S. contractors are not immune anymore from Iraqi laws. So they can't go to streets and start shooting civilians and not be held accountable like they have done in the past many times. Those immunities were suspended. And that is the reason why the U.S. is leaving, actually. That is the most immediate reason why the NATO and the U.S. are leaving. So the answer to your question is no. No one would have any blanket immunities like they used to have.
Thanks. That's good news.
That is. And we started a little late, so I want to give people one more chance to join the stack and ask a question if anyone's been dying to say something.
This is Mary. If there's a little bit of time, I had one.
Yes, please.
Was there anybody? Oh, okay. I kind of lost my phone. I got dropped from the call and had to come back. So if you've already spoken to this, forgive me, but I was just kind of curious about, the Iraqi economy, and I'm wondering what the situation is. I know, in Afghanistan, I don't know, what is it, 75-80% or more depends on foreign aid, and what to talk about U.S. and what we should do with our responsibility and with us leaving and stuff. I just wonder, are there any bright spots? What's the situation? I understand. I know that it's bad, and I know Obama's made some overtures about it, but what we need to happen and what is the reality of the situation?
The Iraqi economy in general, it was completely destroyed in the last 20 years. Iraq turned from one of the most, one of the countries with the strongest economies in the region to one of the economies with one of the worst economies in the region. The only reason why Iraqis survive, of course, is that they have natural resources. Iraq has been exporting oil, and the oil exports that, they don't need any special, expertise by the government. They're just sitting in their green zone, and the oil is pumping. They get, between $100 and $120 billion a year worth of exports. So it's unfortunately those $120 billion, they represent all of the Iraqi income, more or less. There aren't many other sources of income in Iraq. This must be fixed by Iraqis in the coming years to diversify their income, go back to some primary industries and primary sectors like agriculture and other issues that were completely destroyed in the last 20 years. But believe it or not, the Iraqi oil income every year, just the Iraqi oil income, is more than the budgets of Egypt and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon combined. So imagine Syria with more than 80 million people living there, and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon with another 40 to 50 million people. We're talking about 120 or 130 million Arabs who live in neighboring countries. So it's more than four times the Iraqi population, and their countries have less than Iraq's budget by itself. So Iraq has so much potential for reconstruction and for rebuilding. And that brings me back to one of the points that I mentioned earlier regarding the U.S. responsibilities. The U.S. Responsibilities of compensation. Iraqis don't really need this compensation because of its financial value, because of the monetary value. They need it because of its political and moral value. And I think we have to think about it this way. Because Iraq doesn't really need charity or money. They have a lot of money. And they will continue to have a lot of money because of the oil that Iraq has. Iraq is the first or second oil reserve, the largest oil reserve on Earth. And Iraq will have the last oil barrel that will be pumped in the world will come out of Iraq. So there is a lot of oil there, and there is a lot of trillions of dollars worth of oil that Iraqis will enjoy in the future. And it's something important to think about Iraq. That's, of course, different when we talk about Afghanistan. I think the U.S. financial responsibilities towards Afghanistan are important because Afghanistan happens to be a poor country with less natural resources and natural wealth. So, overall, I think that the economy will be moving forward in the next few years. There are many people who are interested in investments there. And overall, we should keep a very smart balance when we talk about investing in Iraq, because I think the two important points here is that on the one hand, we don't want U.S. or multinational oil companies and other multinational companies to go invest in Iraq and loot the Iraqi wealth without being restrained. But on the other hand, we don't want to advocate for boycotting Iraq, because Iraq needs international investments. Iraq needs international companies to go there as well. So somewhere balance, I think somewhere in between, where these companies are welcome in the country, but they are welcome in a way that benefits them and benefits the Iraqi people at the same time.
Great. I want to thank you, Rod, and kind of remind ourselves. I think you've given at least me a couple pillars to think about on our next steps, and in particular, the importance of compensation, which, as you said, it is not charity, but is sort of part of accountability and part of being responsible for the damage that's been done. And I really like the idea of, no more interventions and maybe some sort of campaign about groups and NGOs that are working with the State Department, particularly if the State Department will have their logos on military equipment and will be sort of the armed force in Iraq. I want to thank everyone for joining us and make a quick plug for another event that we're doing on Wednesday, the 28th of December, which will spend even a little more time looking at the legacies of war in Iraq. Rod covered a lot from 1991 on, but we're going to have six speakers on that day. Rod will be one, as well as Kathy Kelly, Rick McDowell, who's a former AFSC staff person in Baghdad, and Mary Trotajo, who was also an AFSC staff person in Baghdad, and Abdullah Obeidi, who worked with Iraqi teens in Egypt as a refugee before he came to the U.S. And we're very much on that event wanting to spend a lot of time looking at the legacy, whereas tonight was time to also look at the mechanics of what withdrawal really looks like and what the end of occupation looks like. the last thing I thought you could leave with us, Rod, is maybe what's one disturbing trend that you're starting to see in the media on coverage around this withdrawal? I get the feeling that since so many major media centers have cut back any international staff, that they don't have very much experience with what really happened in Iraq for the last 20 years. And so what are you noticing that's missing in some of the coverage we're starting to see?
I think one main issue that we can work on, whether it came to mainstream media or mainstream politicians, is that their attempt to put a spin on the end of the occupation and make it seem like everything was okay. It was a success story or something like that. There is no success in what happened in Iraq. There is no happy story. It has been a disaster. And I think even President Obama, who I do give credit to for keeping his promise and withdrawing all of the troops, he is using a very damaging rhetoric when he's talking about how the war, we changed a dictatorship and how our troops should come back home holding their heads high and other types of things that I think are damaging because they make the U.S. public feel like we have done the right thing in Iraq. I think the point that we have to hammer over and over is to say this war, it's good that this war is ending, it's good that this occupation is ending, but ending the occupation does not end our moral responsibilities to compensate Iraqis, to hold those officials from the previous administrations accountable. Those officials are criminals. Some of them are war criminals. Even organizations like Human Rights Watch, which is usually a very mainstream organization that does not take up controversial issues, they have asked the Obama administration to go after officials from the former administration and hold them accountable. So I think that is an important point, that ending the occupation is a step in the right direction, but this was not a happy story, and our moral responsibility and legal responsibility is not over. We have to talk about compensation to Iraq, and we have to talk about holding the politicians and others who committed crimes in Iraq responsible.
Super. Thank you so much. We are going to have a recording of this available. We'll clean it up if there needs some outside noise needs to be wiped off the tape. But that should be available tomorrow. So if any of you are thinking, oh, I know so-and-so would want to hear this and should hear it, just look at the Wage Peace Facebook page and we'll figure out how to have a link on there and how you can get a recording. And thank you so much, Riyad.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for everyone for your time. And if there are any additional questions, you can reach me at my email. It's jarrar.raed@gmail.com.
Thanks so much, Raed. It's so great to hear you again. Appreciate you doing this.
You're welcome.
Raed, right, thanks.
Thank
Peter, thanks for pulling us together.
All right, thanks, everybody, for making time tonight.
Thank you.
All right, thank you all. All right, bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.
All right, good night.
Good night from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Thanks, Len.
Thank you. Please stand by.